Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Bio 231, General Human Anatomy Summer Class, and it is July 30th. And this is the last time we're going to meet this week. It's Thursday. We're going to cover digestive system. Last time we covered respiratory system. Next week, we have two lectures on Monday and one on Tuesday covering urinary and then the diversification system. Then on Wednesday, August 5th, then you have your last lecture exam and your last practicum in lab as well. Okay, so that's pretty much the schedule. I need to look at that schedule all the time so I don't freak out because we're moving pretty fast, but I think things are pretty much in control on this end. Does anybody have a question regarding the schedule? Everybody's pretty good with the schedule? Fantastic. Okay, well, let's finish up respiratory system. And we were talking about control of respiratory system or inputs to the respiratory center. But I guess we should review, where is the respiratory center located? What controls your automatic breathing function and also it helps with the voluntary control of the diaphragm? Where is that? It's partly in the pons, partly in the medulla, right? So brainstem. Breathing is just a very elementary kind of function, and those kinds of functions usually are taken care of in the brainstem. All right, so there are chemoreceptors in your body that are responsible for monitoring the acidity, which we call pH, oxygen concentration, and CO2 concentration. CO2 is just a byproduct of your respiration or your metabolism to produce ATP. Which one of those are most important in influencing or controlling the rate and depth of inspiration? Okay. I used to think it was oxygen until I learned better. It is carbon dioxide. That's right, it is carbon dioxide. So there are very sensitive receptors in the medulla and the pons, in the respiratory center themselves, that monitor CO2, and in a sense that also monitors pH, right? But CO2 is, I would say, is the most important molecule, way more important than oxygen concentration. Oxygen can stimulate inspiration or ventilation, but only when the concentration is drastically reduced. Okay. Well, there are some other things besides chemicals in your body that can influence the rate and depth of ventilation or respiration. Higher centers in the central nervous system, like the cerebral cortex, we have voluntary control over the diaphragm and the other skeletal muscles involved with inspiration, like the external intercostals. So as a matter of fact, we can hold our breath, right? We can just hold our breath for about a minute and a half, I bet we would all just pass out. And as a matter of fact, some kids actually do that to freak their parents out. Oh, you're smiling. Did you do that as a kid? No, you didn't do that as a kid. Okay. But that's possible. We could all do that as an experiment, but maybe not in lecture, maybe in lab we can do that. And then after you pass out, then your automatic centers in the medulla and pons will take over and you'll start breathing again, so it's no big deal. Okay. But you do freak your parents out if you do that. So that's the cerebral cortex, voluntary control. The hypothalamus also is where emotional stimulus eventually ends up, and the hypothalamus can communicate with the respiratory centers to increase the rate and depth of inspiration. So emotional stimulus is also a factor. Then we have proprioceptors. Proprioceptors are like those Golgi tendon organs and muscle spindles that can measure tension and stretch in muscles and tendons and joints, angulation of joints. And when you start to use muscles and bend joints, that sends signals to the respiratory center to increase the rate and depth of respiration. Right? And even if you just passively use muscles, you will have an urgency to breathe. So as a matter of fact, are you exercising right now? Well, somebody's walking up the stairs, so they're exercising. That doesn't count. Okay? But the rest of you guys are not exercising, so you shouldn't be hyperventilating, right? And if you were in really good shape, you wouldn't be hyperventilating either. And it looks pretty good. It doesn't look like you're out of breath. That's excellent. Okay. So if you just sit there and you're not exercising, go ahead and move your arms and move your legs around, your hips, okay? And just that very passive kind of motion, you're not really exercising, you're not lifting any weights or anything, that will stimulate the respiratory center to increase the rate and depth of respiration. Okay. We have other kind of receptors that can play a role, and that is touch. Right? If somebody touches you, that increases, especially if you're unaware that that was going to take place. Pain, if somebody sticks you with a pin, right, that's going to increase the rate and depth of respiration, and temperature as well. If I put an ice cube on your back, right, then your ventilatory rate will increase, right, to just deal with that kind of stimulus. And temperature can produce that gasp reflex. And there's sort of have an interesting story. There are a couple of companies around the coast, mostly in harbors like Newport Harbor, Marina Del Rey Harbor, where they have these boats that you can hold a party on. So you can rent a boat and you can have a wedding party or New Year's Eve party, stuff like that. And a whole bunch of people get there and they get served a nice dinner and drinks and all that kind of stuff. And the boat just kind of goes around the harbor, which, you know, typically we don't do very much in our everyday life. So it's kind of fun. One New Year's Eve in Marina Del Rey, one of those boats with a bunch of people, don't know how many people, at least 50, maybe 100, was tooling around the harbor, just having a good time, and all of a sudden that boat caught on fire and the engine stopped. And it stopped right in the middle of the harbor, so far away from all the docks and shore. They didn't have lifeboats. And so all the people on the boat, because they were afraid of getting burned up, were told to jump off the boat. So there you are in pitch darkness, right? And the water is, what's the water temperature around here, especially in the winter times? Anybody know? It's frigid. It's cold. It hurts, right, when you stick your toe in there, much less your whole body. So these people, to get away from the burning boat, were told to jump off. And I was reading the news reports, and I was astounded that nobody drowned. Right? It's not because they were wearing tuxedos and fancy dresses and jewelry and stuff like that, which they were. Okay, it's because when their body was immersed in this very cold water, then I knew that would stimulate a gasp reflex. As soon as you jump in, you go, oh my God, that's cold. Right? But when you're jumping in from a boat, right, your head usually goes underwater. And when your head's underwater and that gasp reflex takes over, you inhale a whole bunch of water into your lungs, right? And so I was just really amazed nobody drowned, right? And plus, you can imagine what that would be like, jumping off a boat in the middle of the night, cold water like that. And so I figured out probably what happened. Although the boat didn't have lifeboats, they probably had life preservers for everybody. And before they were told to jump, they put on a life preserver, and when they jumped off the boat, their head didn't go underwater. And nonetheless, I'm sure that when they hit the water, they went, how would you go? Oh my God, that's cold. And thank goodness they had life preservers. Okay, so temperature definitely is an important stimulus for ventilation. Okay, so that's it for respiratory center. I have, let's see, what do I have? I have a couple little demonstrations to show you. So let me pull up a slide. Wait a second. Where is it? Oh, no, that was right. Sorry. I did have it set up. Oh, that's not it. This one here. Here it is. Okay, so let's remember the microscopic structure of a lung, which is this thing right here, shown on the right-hand side. So this tube right here that has smooth muscle around it, can this be called a bronchus? A primary bronchus, secondary bronchus, tertiary bronchus, and why? A bronchus always has cartilage around it, so it's held open all the time. This particular tube doesn't have cartilage. It has, what do you see? Smooth muscle. So it can dilate, it can constrict. So this is not a bronchus, this is a bronchiole. Okay? Then it bifurcates into some what we call respiratory bronchioles because it has that structural and functional unit of gas exchange in the lung. What do we call that structural and functional unit of gas exchange in the lung? It is, the capillary is the blood vessel for exchange for sure. That's part of that structural and functional unit. The other part is the alveolus, right? So the alveolus. So if you know how that alveolus works, you really know a lot about ventilation. Okay? So the alveolus has those type 2 cells that secrete surfactants that prevent the alveolus from collapsing. It has a nice capillary network around it for exchange of gases. It also has these elastic fibers so that when you inhale and expand an alveolus to exhale that air, all you have to do is relax muscles and that air is pushed out of the lungs. Okay, so I want to look at a couple things right here. And I want to ask you, which is a better model of an alveolus? All right, so what do I have right here? Got a paper bag and I have a balloon. Okay, and let's pretend these are alveoli, and so they're going to inflate with air. Let's inflate the paper bag first and see what happens. Okay, I got this paper bag last night on the way home. Had a nice fancy bottle inside of it. I took the bottle out, now I just got a paper bag. Okay, so I'm going to inflate the paper bag. Okay, so it closed off the mouth of the paper bag so that air can't escape, right? And then I'm going to let go. What's going to happen to the air inside this bag when I let go of it? Look at that. It stays the same shape. So that air that's inside, I'll even open it up to make sure that it's not blocked, right? All right, so it's opened up. That air that went into that alveolus is staying in that alveolus. It's not leaving, okay? So let's compare that paper bag with this balloon. Okay, and sometimes these balloons rip. I hope that doesn't happen. All right, so I'm going to blow up this alveolus. All good. It didn't rip. Sometimes they blow up. Okay, so here, oop. Well, there went that demonstration. Oh, but I have a glove. Maybe a glove will work. Not quite as good. Okay, so here is a glove we use. I think it's clean. Okay, so here I have a glove. This is an alveolus. And now what happens if I let go of the glove? What's going to happen to the air inside this glove? It leaves. Why is that? What can you tell me about this glove? It's different than the paper bag, right? Because the glove has elastic properties. The bag does not. So which is a better model of an alveolus? My nice rubber glove or the paper bag? The rubber glove, right? Because it has elastic properties. And so that also demonstrates when somebody loses those elastic fibers in their lungs, right, that drastically reduces pulmonary function and it can put them in respiratory distress as well. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing I wanted to demonstrate for you was that water is sticky. That an alveolus, if the walls of the alveolus touch each other, they're going to get stuck together because there's water there, and water is sticky. All right, so how can I show you that water is sticky? I got a couple of transparencies right here, and they're dry. And if I put them together, hold them up, and just hold one of them, I'm going to hold the one in the back. If I just hold one of them, what's going to happen to the one in the front if I let go? Gravity is going to pull on it, and it's just going to fall away, right? So they weren't glued together at all. Let's glue them together. Where are we going to get some glue? Water. And here we got some water right here. Hopefully, oh, here's a water bottle. Okay, not anything special, just a water bottle. So let me put some water on there, like so. Nice. I'll stick these together, like so. All right, and I'm going to make sure that they're touching each other, like that. And then I'm going to pick them up. All right, so I'm holding both of them. And now I'm only going to hold, I'll do it the same way, I'm only going to hold the one in the back. What's going to happen to the one in the front besides dripping water? It's not going to fall down. right? It's glued together. Now, what is that force like? All right. So I want a volunteer to grab this bottom one. I'll hold the top one, and we'll try to separate it. We'll try to separate it and give us an impression of how tough that is. Oh, it's kind of sliding. That wasn't too bad. Okay. But there's actually a lot of tension. I don't know. I'm pulling on it pretty much. Oops. Oh, I just yanked it right out of my hand, right? So if an alveolus didn't have the type 2 cells secreting surfactant, the alveoli would get stuck together, the walls would touch each other, and an alveolus... Let's try that again. Why was that so easy? Okay. Amazing how sticky water is. Okay, I can't explain why it worked differently those two different times. But, all right, so that's the function of what compound that defeats surface tension? Surfactant, right? And it comes from a type 2 cell, okay? And if somebody's born prematurely, those type 2 cells are not activated, especially by cesarean section, and a newborn baby's lungs won't inflate. Right, and what do you do for an infant then? Respirator, right? You increase the oxygen concentration in their environment for them. All right, so that's it for respiratory chapter. And I'll put this away. Then we're going to move into the digestive system. All right, let me see what I can remember about the digestive system. Well, first, we're going to look at the components of the digestive system. Nice. Okay. So here is a nice illustration of your digestive tract. Sometimes it's called the alimentary tract. And remember, it's just a tube that runs through your body. The lumen of that tube is really a space that is outside your body. So if there is a nutrient in this tube that's running through your body, in order for it to get in your body, it has to be absorbed into your body. So that's going to be an important thing. So what are the components of the digestive system? Well, there are some things directly responsible for absorption, then there's some accessory structures. So let's just follow the tube first. All right, so food goes in the oral cavity, right, and then it goes into the pharynx, that's the back of your throat, then down this really long tube through the thoracic cavity into the stomach. That really long tube is the esophagus. Right, and here is the stomach. So the stomach is kind of like a really big pouch. Food that we eat stays in the stomach for a period of time. We'll talk about why in a little bit. Then that food that has been eaten moves into the small intestine. So the small intestine has three parts. The most proximal part, the part that is attached to the stomach, is the duodenum. Right, and then in the middle, there's a part called the jejunum, and then the most distal part that joins up with the large intestine is called the ileum. So those are the three divisions. Starting from proximal to distal, it's duodenum, jejunum, and ileum. And for me, it's kind of hard to tell which is which, but I can for sure see that this is duodenum. I can see this is the ileum because here is the large intestine, and I can see it emptying into the large intestine. All right, so we got oral cavity, esophagus, stomach, small intestine, then large intestine. The first part of the large intestine that the ileum empties into is called the cecum. All right, so we have the cecum, and then we have ascending colon, transverse colon, descending, and then here is a curvy part, which is called the sigmoid colon, and then the anal canal and anus. All right, so that's the whole alimentary tract. Some of the accessory structures, we have salivary glands. In lab you learn that there are three of these, parotid, right, sublingual, submandibular, and here is the liver. Liver is important because it helps produce something that acts like a detergent so that the lipids that we eat, the fats that we eat, can be emulsified or broken down into small pieces so that they can be digested. Here's gallbladder. Right, gallbladder stores that compound for emulsification, and then here is the pancreas. The pancreas produces digestive enzymes. Pancreas also produces some hormones, so the pancreas has two main functions. It's part endocrine and exocrine. In the digestive chapter, we're going to look at the exocrine function of the pancreas. So exocrine gland is what? A gland that has ducts. So those digestive enzymes are put into the main pancreatic duct, which then empties directly into the small intestine. All right, so these are the pieces. Did I miss anything? I did not. All right. Well, just like in blood vessels, when we were interested in layers, we're interested in layers of the digestive tract as well. Okay, and here are the layers. So here is an exam figure. You have a model in lab that follows this illustration that you should be familiar with. So when you look at that model in lab, maybe you want to open up this figure to look at. So let's start with the deepest layer, okay, which is number 4 on this slide. The most superficial layer, okay, the most superficial, which is number 4. That's called the serosa. It is connective tissue, right, and it's also very moist and slippery. So these intestines move around all the time. That serosa helps protect that particular tube and allows it to squish around inside your abdominal cavity. So here's that most superficial layer. The next deepest layer is the muscularis externa. So here are some smooth muscles that I can see. And the superficial layer is what we call the longitudinal layer. These smooth muscles are oriented along the length of the tube, and this tube could be stomach, right? Could be small intestine, could be large intestine. This is just an overall representation of some part of the alimentary canal. So this is what we call the longitudinal layer, and then right below it, we see some smooth muscle cells that are oriented in a transverse fashion, right? From left to right, not from end to end, but from left to right or top to bottom. And so then we call this the circular smooth muscle because it actually makes a circle around the tube. So with these two muscle types, right, the circular can pinch, right, it can constrict, and the longitudinal layer can make the tube shorter because it can pull the ends together. And so material moves through our digestive tract by these two different kinds of motions that we're going to look at, this pinching motion or the squeezing motion versus the contraction motion of the alimentary canal. All right, so that's the first two layers, serosa, muscularis externa. Oh, I'm not quite done yet with the muscularis externa. All of these yellow things right here are nerves, and we call this the myenteric nerve plexus. And you have more nerves in your digestive tract than you do in your spinal cord, which is pretty amazing because all of your intestines are coordinated with each other via this nerve plexus. And people knew this for years and years and years, a long time ago, and people actually thought that your brain was in your digestive tract because it had so many neurons, right? The myenteric nerve plexus. You can see that in lab as well. Okay, then we have submucosa. Here we have submucosa, and you can see some nerves going to the submucosa as well. There are glands in the submucosa. There's a lot of blood vessels as well. So it's a loose connective tissue, blood vessels, arteries, and veins. And it is controlled, right, or influenced or stimulated by the parasympathetic nervous system. Not the sympathetic nervous system, and certainly not the somatic nervous system. You don't have voluntary control. All right, so what is the function of parasympathetic stimulation of the digestive tract? Is it inhibitory or excitatory? And how could you remember that pretty easily? Okay, remember, sympathetic is fight or flight. What is parasympathetic? Rest and digest, right? So digest is the clue. So the parasympathetic nervous system increases motility, increases secretion, right? So it is excitatory to digestive processes, right? So that's why the parasympathetic nerve goes there. All right, the next deepest layer we see right here, and again, I see some smooth muscle. It's a lot thinner than the externa, and we call this the muscularis mucosa, because these are muscles once again, but they're in the mucosal layer. And the submucosa has glands, and it has ducts, right, that carry this, their products into the lumen of this particular tube. This material, this loose connective material, sometimes is called lamina propria. Here it is, lamina propria. And then the lining of the tube, right, there's something that lines a cavity. We call that a membrane. And if that cavity is open to the outside world, what kind of membrane is that? It could either be serous membrane or mucus. If it's open to the outside world, it's a mucus membrane. So here is the mucus membrane, and it is different depending on what part of the digestive tract you're in. Right in your mouth, it's a stratified squamous epithelium in the oral cavity. In other places, it's a simple columnar epithelium, and that's what the deepest layer of the intestine is. All right. We also have, besides glands, we also have a lot of germinal centers. We have places where there are aggregations of white blood cells, right, both lymphocytes and macrophages, because there are a lot of bacteria living in our digestive tract, especially our large intestine, and that is normal. Those most bacteria, well, under normal circumstances, those bacteria are helpful to us, right? So we call them normal microbiota. They can help produce vitamins that our body, our own body, can't make, right? So they are important. But there are other kinds of bacteria which are pathologic, which will cause disease, and so there is immune system tissue, there's MALT in the submucosa and the mucosa. Probably I see a little node right here. It's not, is it a label? Oh yeah, here, mucosa associated lymphatic tissue. That just makes sure that pathologic bacteria that are in the digestive system don't make their way through the digestive tract or into the wall of the intestine and then to the rest of your body. All right, so there's MALT all over the place. All right, so those are the layers. All right, so we got a couple different layers of muscles are oriented in different ways. And so there are different ways that material can move through the digestive tract. The two ways are peristalsis and segmentation. So I want to go back to peristalsis and segmentation. And we see the two forms right here. And you'll notice that there has to be a lot of coordination between different elements of the alimentary tract or this tube, right? And that's why there's a myenteric nerve plexus. Okay, so here is a bolus of food and your mouth is superior and the rest of the digestive tract is below. Right, so if the circular muscles contract and the contraction moves, right, from proximal to distal, that's going to force this bolus of food along the digestive tract from a proximal place to a more distal place. Right, so this little pinching will just kind of flow down the tube and this material will move along with it. That is what we call peristalsis. All right, when adjacent segments of the alimentary tract organs alternately contract and relax, moving food in one direction. That's the important thing. Peristalsis is moving food in one direction, right, in the forward direction. The other kind of motion we see right here is when we have different compartments, so we have different constrictions and different positions along the alimentary tract. Right? So here we have one compartment, here's another one that's just colored a little bit differently, and then a third one, right, that is colored a little bit differently. And so what happens now, these constrictions relax, and this relaxed part starts to constrict. Right? So food doesn't move in any particular direction, but what happens is that the bottom part of this first chamber then ends up with the top part of the chamber that's down below it. Right, so that carries some of the light colored food with the dark colored food. And so what is this doing? This is mixing these different compartments or the different divisions or different places of the alimentary tract together. Right. And then what happens here? Since these two compartments are now being mixed together, then it goes back, right, to where this relaxed part starts to constrict, right? And over a period of time, this homogenizes or mixes up all of the different contents of the elementary canal in this segment of the intestinal tract. So segmentation is what we call a mixing function, right? A mixing function. Food does not move in any particular direction. It just gets stirred up as a result of that. All right, so that mixes up digestive juices with the food that we eat. All right, so remember these two different kinds. And what direction is enterograde? Forward or backward? Enterograde. Enterograde is forward direction. What's the reverse direction? Retrograde, right? So peristalsis is completely enterograde motion, but segmentation is both enterograde and retrograde because it's a mixing function. All right, so this is kind of a complicated scheme, and that's why you have that nice myenteric nerve plexus that's controlling all of these different contractions. All right, salivary glands. We know where those salivary glands are, and they secrete anywhere from 3/4 of a liter of fluid to 1.5 liters of fluid into your mouth every day. So 1.5 liters. How much is that? Oh my goodness. What is this bottle right here? 700 mLs. All right. So 1.5 liters would be 2 of these. So you produce 2 of these bottles of saliva every day, okay, which is a lot. And just trust me, okay? Don't go around and collect it a day and see if I'm right. So just trust me on that. All right. Well, that's a lot of fluid. And as that fluid moves from your body into your elementary canal or into your mouth, right, it leaves your body because that canal is not inside your body. It's really outside. It's a tube running through it, but it's still on the outside. So you're losing that amount of fluid, right? So you are dehydrating. But the benefit is that saliva acts as a lubricant because it has some mucus in there so that this bolus of food can move through the esophagus. But there's also some enzymes there that can digest complex sugars down into simple sugars. So the initial digestion of food that we eat starts in our oral cavity. Right? But it's not very important because we don't chew our food for a very long period of time. And as soon as that food enters the stomach is very acidic, and it will then stop that enzymatic activity. It will stop that enzymatic activity. So that digestion of sugars in your mouth is very short-lived. Because how long do you chew food for? Like a minute after you take a bite of something? Minute? 2 minutes? 3 minutes? Oh, 4 minutes. Oh, I'm going in the wrong direction. Okay, so 4, 3, 2, 1. 30 seconds? Probably not even 30 seconds. Right, so maybe 10 seconds. So that's not a lot of time for that enzyme called amylase to digest complex sugars, and those complex sugars are what we call starch. All right, so this fluid and food that we eat enters the stomach. So how does it get from your oral cavity to your stomach? What's the name of that tube? I want to find it because I do want to say something about it. What is this one here? That's it. What's this one here? This is respiratory chapter. I'm done with that one. Okay. So where is that tube located once again? Okay. And I see it here. That's probably pretty good. Let's just take a look here for fun. Nah, too complicated. What about here? Liver. This is below the... A little bit below the stomach already. Okay, so we got to use this figure here. All right, so here's that tube, right, between that connects the oral cavity with the stomach, and that is the esophagus. All right, the esophagus is just a muscular wall. Does it look like it has any cartilage around it? It doesn't have any cartilage, so it's not held open all the time. It is closed. And I guess that's sort of fortunate because if you bring some food over to this area right above the esophagus and drop it, it can't fall into the esophagus and get stuck, like if it was a trachea, right? Can't just fall into the stomach because the esophagus is normally closed. Right. But there is an important consequence. Because the esophagus is normally closed, the walls of the esophagus touch each other all the time. Right, the mucosa layer is bumping up against the mucosa on the other side of the tube. And when the esophagus gets damaged, it heals, and there's scar tissue that forms like any other injured area of your body, right? And that scar tissue then closes off the esophagus completely, right? So that scar tissue, probably you've had a scar someplace on your body that you can look at. Well, that scar forms in the esophagus, right? And then somebody can't ever swallow food again. And nobody has ever figured out how to let the esophagus heal so that it is open, so that it is patent. So that's pretty lousy when that happens to you. I think they're beginning to develop some techniques to where they can make sure that the esophagus heals so that it is patent in that area of injury, but I don't think that happens all the time, right? And that's just recent. That's just within the last couple of years. But it used to be all the time when the esophagus is damaged, it's no longer useful because of that scar tissue. All right, so how can the esophagus get damaged? Well, if you're getting anesthesia and somebody puts in an endotracheal tube that's supposed to go in your trachea and they miss and they put it in the esophagus, that can rip the esophagus. All right, so if you're getting anesthesia that way, make sure that you work with an anesthesiologist that has done this procedure before. Don't be the first patient. Right? Make sure you work with somebody that knows what they're doing, that has experience. Another easy way to damage the esophagus is to swallow something that is caustic, like gasoline or drain cleaner or other kinds of chemicals that you have around the house, right? And or other kinds of cleaning products. And some of these cleaning products have perfumes in them so they don't smell too bad. And that just shows you that it's really important to take household chemicals and put them in a place where children can't get at them because they might think it's a soda pop or something that is good to drink and very tasty. So they might drink some drain cleaner and terribly burn their esophagus and that child won't be able to swallow again. All right, so that is terrible. Or gasoline, right? Store chemicals only in properly labeled containers. Right, so if I come over to your house for a party some after school is over and you put some gasoline in a Coke bottle in your garage and I'm just kind of walking around and I see a Coke bottle, I could even drink some of that gasoline, right? So make sure you put all these harmful compounds in a properly labeled container so that adults don't even consume something that's very caustic. Yeah, question.
Well,
we call that parenteral nutrition. So it can be delivered by IV, okay, and somebody gets a permanent line fixed. Or sometimes maybe a tube can be forced through that constriction. And so they will be able to get what? Liquefied nutrition. So there's probably a couple different ways to get around that, okay? None are very convenient, right? So, but you don't have to die if there is an occlusion of the esophagus, but it's certainly not very, very convenient. Okay, so properly labeled containers hide those nasty chemicals. All right, so that's the significance of the esophagus because it's not held open all the time. All right, so contents get into the stomach. The function of the stomach, this might seem a little strange because this is part of your digestive tract. The function, the main function of the stomach is for storing and mixing food that we eat. And do you see the word absorption there? It is not in that list. It is storing and mixing, so absorption, very little absorption takes place in the stomach, even though it is the and absorption and digestion, right? So storing and mixing, not so much digestion, even though it's part of the digestive tract. Okay, so what motion is mixing? Is it peristalsis or segmentation? Yeah, it's segmentation, right? So that's why the stomach, I think you saw this in your lab quiz, doesn't have just two layers of muscularis externa. It has how many? It's got three, right? It's got longitudinal, and it's got transverse, and damn, I forgot the third one. Okay, very good, thank you. Okay, because that's the job of the stomach, is to mix certain kinds of secretions with the food that we eat. So what are some of the secretions? Pepsin is an enzyme that breaks down proteins. That's a kind of, it's one of the basic kinds of biological molecules that make our body. Protein, probably you've heard of a protein before. Do you know what a basic building block of a protein is? Probably some do. It's an amino acid, right? Amino acids, these are the small building blocks of a protein. Put a bunch of them together, you get a protein. All right, so proteins are one class of biological compounds that are necessary for you. There are a couple others, right? So there are carbohydrates and there are lipids. So lipids, proteins, carbohydrates are the three big main ones. And you could also say nucleic acids, which help make up DNA. Those are the four. And so pepsin is important for breaking down one of that class of chemicals, namely proteins. Proteins are really tough to digest. And what happens, right, in the stomach is that pepsin and that initial digestion of protein is so tough that the acidity of the stomach is very high. So the stomach also secretes hydrochloric acid into the lumen of the stomach so that pepsin can do its job. Right, so there has to be really radical conditions in order for this initial digestion. And it's only an initial, it's not a complete digestion, just a partial digestion of proteins. Okay, so the stomach secretes hydrochloric acid and pepsin. It also secretes an important compound called intrinsic factor. And intrinsic factor is secreted into the lumen of the stomach because it's important for absorption of vitamin B12. And we haven't talked about vitamin B12, but vitamin B12 is necessary for mitosis to take place. And is mitosis an important function in our body? Yeah, because we lose 2 million red blood cells every second, right? They have to be replaced. 2 million every second. Vitamin B12 is necessary for that function so that when somebody doesn't have vitamin B12 in their diet, they become anemic. Right? Or if somebody's stomach can't secrete intrinsic factor, right, then they can't absorb vitamin B12 even if it is in their diet. There's a population that's well known to be deficient in vitamin B12 because it's never found in their diet. Can anybody think of a population of people who are chronically deprived of vitamin B12? And it is alcoholics. Okay, because if there are people that are just drinking all the time and not eating, right, they become anemic because there's no vitamin B12 in their diet. Okay, so what all these things are mixed together, that produces chyme. Chyme is that material in the stomach. It's all mixed together. Okay, let's look at some of these cells that secrete these products. Oh, and what is the volume? So all these things that are secreted into the stomach are called is called gastric juice. So it's highly acidic. There's enzymes, right? And your stomach secretes another 1.5 liters into the stomach every day. 1.5 liters of gastric juice into the stomach. So how much water has your body lost already when you consider salivary glands and the stomach? I think it was 1.5. So 3 liters of water you've lost already, right? So you can become very dehydrated as a part of this particular process. All right, so in the mucosa, you have goblet cells that secrete mucus. Here's a nice mouth. Don't want a nice mouth. Okay, so here's a nice cross-section through the stomach. You can see the serosa, longitudinal circular layer, oblique layer, right? Then here's the submucosa, and then here is the mucosa. And we're going to look at, okay, these little invaginations from the lumen, and we call these things gastric pits, because if you look from the top, they just kind of look like a pit. Well, these things have secretory cells, and here are some of the secretory cells, right? You have a chief cell. And a chief cell secretes an enzyme that starts to break down lipids. That's called lipase. And it secretes a compound called pepsinogen. Pepsinogen is a precursor to pepsin. So if you ever hear a name of an enzyme with an ogen, or actually any kind of chemical with an ogen at the end of it, it means that it is inactive but can be activated pretty easily inside your body. So here's a digestive enzyme made deep in this gastric pit. Okay, it's not secreted in an active form because then it would digest the stomach away all by itself. So it moves up into the lumen of the stomach where it is activated. Pepsinogen is converted into pepsin, okay, as a result of mixing with the product of a parietal cell. And a parietal cell secretes hydrochloric acid. Okay, so hydrochloric acid, pepsinogen, enter the lumen of the stomach. A parietal cell also produces intrinsic factor necessary for absorption of vitamin B12. And this lining here has to have goblet cells, right? And do I see goblet cells? Oh, I don't see a goblet cell, but it has to have a goblet cell. And remember, what's the job of a goblet cell? It produces and secretes mucus, right? And so mucus lines all of these tissues right here, and mucus is a protein as well as a sugar. It's a modified sugar protein put together, and it is very tough to digest. And so that layer of mucus protects the lining of the stomach from autodigestion. That's an important function of those goblet cells. So not only, right, do they lubricate, they also make a nice barrier that prevents hydrochloric acid from eating your stomach away. That is pretty important. There are also cells over here that secrete hormones. All right, so what do we call a tissue that secretes a hormone? I give you a hint. It's a gland. What kind of gland secretes a hormone? An endocrine gland. That's right. And so the stomach is an endocrine gland because it secretes hormones that regulate activity of itself and other parts of the digestive tract. All right, so that's really not obvious to think of your stomach as an endocrine gland. And the endocrine is, or the hormone is called gastrin. And gastrin signals the parietal cells to secrete hydrochloric acid when food enters the stomach. So when food enters the stomach, it stretches the stomach, and those enteroendocrine cells secrete gastrin, which increases motility, which is the function, the primary function of the stomach. Okay. There are also undifferentiated cells. An undifferentiated cell can become different types of cells in your body, depending on the level of undifferentiation. And since the lining of the stomach is in such a caustic environment, right, it is extremely acidic, and there's all kinds of digestive enzymes right there, including pepsin. These cells in the mucosa have a very short life, and so they have to be replaced. And the lining of your stomach is replaced about every 3 to 6 days, right? Because otherwise there would just be a big hole in your stomach. What do we call a big hole in somebody's stomach or small intestine? That is an ulcer. That's an ulcer, right? And those can be deadly. All right, so that high level of mitosis, right, regenerates the stomach because it's in a really tough neighborhood. All right, so pH. Talk about pH for just a second. The pH, a neutral pH is 7, and the most acidic pH that there can be is 0. So as something becomes more acidic, it goes from 7 to 6 to 5 to 4 to 3 to 1 to 0. The pH of the stomach is about 1. It's extremely acidic, right? So the stomach can dissolve itself very easily. These enteroendocrine cells are at the bottom of that gastric pit, and the bottom part sometimes we call a gland, a gastric gland. All these secretions we call gastric juice, and we produce 1.5 liters of gastric juice every day. All right, so where does food go then from the stomach? It goes into the small intestine. I tell you what, let's take a look, you know pretty much about the stomach, but let's look at it for just a little bit. You know the anatomy. Okay, so here's the esophagus entering the stomach, and we like to consider, okay, that there is a sphincter at the junction between the esophagus and the stomach. And how is a sphincter and a orbicularis muscle similar? A sphincter and an orbicularis. They're both circular, right? They're both circular. And a sphincter is smooth muscle. It's not under voluntary control. So it's a little bit different in that sense, right? Because orbicularis is skeletal muscle. And when that ring of skeletal smooth muscle contracts, that closes off the esophagus from the stomach, which you might think is, well, then how does food get out of the esophagus into the stomach? Well, it does because of that myenteric nerve plexus. But more importantly, it prevents the acid contents of the stomach from moving up into the esophagus. And the esophagus is not protected as much as the stomach from autodigestion. So if gastric juice enters the esophagus, that can cause an ulcer in the esophagus as well. And it's unfortunate, but this cardiac sphincter right here is very weak and almost non-existent in some people. And so they get a lot of what we call reflux up into the esophagus, and they have heartburn, and it can be very uncomfortable, and some people actually have to sleep kind of sitting up in bed to prevent, right, that reflux up into the esophagus. All right, so normally, how does that work? Well, this is a functional sphincter because the esophagus comes straight down into the level of the stomach, and then it makes a nice 90-degree bend. And so when it makes that 90-degree bend, all right, take a straw, all right, think of a straw that you have, and it's patent, fluid can move through the straw. Now bend the straw, put a 90-degree bend in the straw. What have you done when you've done that? You have blocked off the straw, right, because you've pinched the straw at that location. All right, so that's what happens here at the cardiac sphincter. It's really the pinching motion that acts as a sphincter. Nonetheless, this area right here is called the cardiac area, or the cardia of the stomach. So the cardia is right near the esophagus, entrance of the esophagus, and students confuse this all the time with another part of the stomach, which is the most superior part. This is the part that traps gas. That's pretty much why it's there. This is the fundus. Right, so be sure you look at these lead lines if you have to label any of these things. I don't think anybody missed it on the quiz, which is wonderful. Right, but if you see this on a practicum or the lecture exam, make sure that you know what the most superior part of the stomach is. What's the most superior part? The fundic region or fundus, right? And then the cardiac region is down by the esophagus, a lot different place. You see the three different muscle layers. You see another nice sphincter. This is where I got into talking about this particular figure. So this is the sphincter that controls the entry of chyme into the small intestine. And we call this the pyloric sphincter. So this is the pyloric canal, pyloric region of the stomach. The pyloric sphincter is very big and strong. Okay? And it's important to regulate the flow of material from the stomach into the small intestine because it takes a while for the small intestine to do its job. And if the stomach was always emptying chyme into the small intestine couldn't do its job, and then you wouldn't receive that nutrition. Plus some other things would happen too that we're going to talk about. Okay, so this pyloric sphincter is really important. It regulates the material that's entering the duodenum. Anybody ever see the Lucille Ball show? Who's Lucille Ball? She's an actress from way back, right? A long time ago, her TV shows are still on. They had a scene with her friend, Ethel Merman, I think was her name, and they were working at a chocolate factory, right? And there's a conveyor belt, and their chocolate candy is coming down the conveyor belt, and their job was to take these candies, wrap them up, and put them in a container, right? So it's very efficient. And then as the scene progressed, it went from one chocolate every 5 seconds to one chocolate every two to one chocolate every second to where there were all of a sudden 10 chocolates every second. And of course, they couldn't keep up with wrapping all the chocolates, right? And so the chocolates were falling off the conveyor belt. They started eating them, stuffing them in their mouth because they didn't want to get caught not wrapping all these chocolates, right? And it was a total mess. So think of the job of this pyloric sphincter right here is to protect the function of the duodenum so that it's not asked to wrap so many chocolates that it can't handle. All right, so that's the job of this pyloric sphincter. All right, make sure you know the other parts of the stomach. All right, so there's a little bit of difference between the cardiac sphincter and this pyloric sphincter. Okay, small intestine. The function of the small intestine, I tell you what, let's go back to the stomach. Function of the stomach is for storing food until the small intestine is ready to work on it, and mixing, right? The function of the small intestine is a lot different, This is typically what we think the digestive tract should do. Its primary function is digestion and absorption of building blocks that you need for your life. So there are intestinal glands that secrete almost 2 liters of intestinal juice every day into your small intestine. All right, so now how much fluid have we lost? Well, it was 1.5, right, for saliva, 1.5 for gastric juice, that's 3. And then, just for fun, let's not just say 1.8, let's just say 2 for easy counting. So we got 3 plus 5 liters of fluid now your body has lost because it's put it into a tube that's running through your body. All right, so keep track of that. So what is that? 3, 4, 5. 5 liters so far. Okay, so the divisions of the small intestine coming right out of the stomach is the duodenum. And then there is the ileum. Right, and then there is, next is the jejunum. I'm trying to find a picture. I don't have a picture of the whole small intestine. Okay. And then the last division is what we call the ileum. So you got duodenum, jejunum, and ileum. The ileum is part of the small intestine which occupies this area. I'm showing you the large intestine right now, but I'm circling where the small intestine would be. And that last part of it, I see right here, this is part of the ileum. That's the part that empties into the large intestine, in particular at the cecum. And there's another important sphincter there. That sphincter, and it's powerful, and it's big, it's called the ileo, named after the ileum, cecal valve. Ileo, cecal valve. Remember, we can put words together in anatomy as long as we put an O. And we find it right here. All right, so the function we said was digestion and absorption. So there has to be some interesting structures that help in absorption. So what do you need for absorption? We talked about this last time. Okay, what increases absorption? Or movement of material across a membrane. Or movement of something from one room in your house to another room in your house. What do you need? What do you need to get from one room in your house to another room? You need a? How did you get into this classroom? What did you walk through? A doorway. Yeah, you need a doorway, right? So food entering your body or nutrition entering your body has to go through a doorway. And scientifically, what we think of a doorway as is surface area, right? Surface area. And as we increase the surface area, what happens to the rate of absorption? It increases, right? So a lot more people can go through a big garage door than a little pedestrian door that we have right here. So as surface area increases, absorption is increased. Okay, so there are some modifications to the small intestine to increase, right, the surface area for absorption. And so we're going to look at these modifications of the small intestine. Okay. If we were to look at the small intestine and just think of it as a garden hose without any modifications in there, the surface area would be about 3.5 square feet. Okay? Not very much of it. It's just like a garden hose or some simple kind of straight tube. Right? But when we consider all of the different kinds of folds, right, that are in the small intestine, look what happens to the surface area. It's increased from 3.5 square feet to 2,200 square feet. So even though the small intestine, in a sense, is relatively short, it acts like, what, a tremendously long tube because there's a lot of folds. All right, so what is 2,200 square feet? All right, well, that's 47 times 47 feet, or, 47, that should be meters right here. And that's about 240 square meters. What does that mean in terms of, we don't even want to think about it in terms of tennis courts. Let's think of a house, right? That's the floor area of an average two-level house. That is the doorway for exchange in the small intestine because of these modifications, which are plicae circularis, villi, and microvilli. Let's take a look and make sure you know where these things are. So here's the small intestine. Nice straight tube. You see some layers, right, like muscularis externa. Then here is the mucosa. And if we look at the mucosa, is it flat, straight, and smooth? Or do you see wrinkles in there? I see wrinkles, right? I see folds. And these are what we call circular folds, or another way of saying is plique circularis. Plique circularis just means circular pleats or circular folds. All right, so if we really want to consider the length of this tube, we would have to pull on either end of the tube and straighten all of these folds out. And when we do that, what would be the length of the small intestine? It would be a lot longer, right, to straighten all those folds out. Okay. On each of these circular folds, I see some more folds. Do you see these other folds right here? These are what we call villi. These are almost microscopic, but not quite. We can get an impression if we look at the small intestine. We can do that today in lab if you want, cut open a small intestine. The surface of the small intestine is going to look like velvet, right? It's going to have a little velvety appearance to it. So you can almost see these villi. So if we want to straighten all of these folds out, right, then we have to pull the small intestine to straighten out the plique circularis. We'd have to keep pulling to straighten all of these villi out as well. And now the small intestine gets extremely long, even though it's all folded up, right? It's very short because it's all folded up. All right, so that's two things, right? The villi. So here is a villus, and we can look on the inside of the villus. It has an arterial supply, has a capillary. What's the function of this capillary? Exchange, and in this particular case, we're mostly interested in absorption of nutrients. And then here's a vein coming out of the villus, bringing nutrients to our body. Here's some malt in there, okay, to prevent infection. Then here is the mucosa lining. And if we look at the cells of this line, can you tell me what kind of epithelium this is right here? Can you kind of take a look at that? Okay, it's columnar. Yeah, I see a goblet cell, right? So there's mucus that's secreted onto the villi to protect them from autodigestion. And if we look at the apical surface of these absorptive cells, let's move over here. And let's pretend this is a nice columnar cell. Almost looks cuboidal here, but let's just say it's columnar. Look at the apical surface compared to the basal surface. The basal surface is flat and smooth, but what about this basal surface? What does it have all over the place? It has more folds. These folds are really hard to see underneath a microscope. These are what we call microvilli. I think you've learned about them already, microvilli. So in order to really understand how long the small intestine is, right, we would have to pull on the small intestine to straighten out all of the plique circularis, to straighten out all the villi, and keep pulling until we straighten out all of the microvilli. And that's how come the surface area of your small intestine is about the floor area of a standard two-level house. It's huge, right? So the surface area is huge, which means the doorway is huge as well. All right, so most water-soluble things that are absorbed in your body enter your body through this capillary. But lipids enter your body through a different kind of capillary, not a vascular capillary. And the other kind of capillary that you learned about was a lymph capillary. Right? And here is that lymph capillary that runs right up the very center of a villus. And this thing right here is responsible for absorbing lipids. And this is what we call a lacteal. Lacteal is a lymph capillary that's found in every villus. Okay. All right, so those are the modifications of the small intestine, some important functional characteristics. So what else do you have to know about? Well, there's undifferentiated cells, right? Because, again, the cells of the small intestine are replaced every 3 to 6 days because it's in a really rough environment. And that's why when somebody's on chemotherapy that's designed to reduce mitosis of a rapidly dividing tumor, one of the hardest hit areas in their body is their digestive tract, right? Because then these cells can't replace themselves every 3 to 6 days. That's just a side effect of that chemotherapy. Here is a Brunner's gland, and it's important for secreting mucus and immune factors to prevent infection. Here's some other glands that are important for secreting a compound that will neutralize the acid that's coming from the stomach. All right, so what do you use to neutralize an acid? You have to use a, well, we haven't had chemistry in here. You have to use a base, right? You have to use a base. So a base is secreted into the stomach, especially in the duodenum, that neutralizes the acid so that the small intestine isn't harmed. That base is called bicarbonate. Where do you have it on your slide? You have it someplace. You have bicarbonate. Ah, here, bicarbonate, okay? And bicarbonate then neutralizes the gastric juice entering the small intestine. Okay, and again, mucus is there for protecting the wall of the small intestine. The small intestine also secretes hormones from enteroendocrine cells. In this little invagination, we don't call this a pit, we just call this a crypt. It's not quite so deep as a gastric pit. And there are two hormones, secretin and cholecystokinin, that are secreted by these endocrine cells. So the small intestine, just like the stomach, is an endocrine gland. We don't know all the parts of the small intestine yet, so just remember that these are two names of hormones, and when we learn all the other places of the intestine, then we'll take a look at what the functions of these hormones are. Okay. All right, so that's it for the small intestine. Has all the layers that you're familiar with. All right, pancreas. So we sort of know where the pancreas is. Let's take a quick look where the pancreas is. Let's look up here first. All right, so here we got esophagus. Here we have stomach. So the pancreas lies just below and posterior to the stomach. That's where you're going to find it in your fetal pig. So find the stomach, kind of move the stomach a little bit superior, and we find the pancreas. So we can zoom into the pancreas a little bit better by looking at this picture right here. Okay, so here's the pancreas. We've removed the stomach. We see some tubes going between the liver. I think you can recognize that as liver, right, and the pancreas. The pancreas is very close to the first initial segment of the small intestine, which is the duodenum. Okay, so let's look at the pancreas. There are some ducts. So here's a duct. And so the pancreas produces a compound that enters this duct, and then that product enters the small intestine. So the pancreas is a gland. And what kind of gland is that if there's a duct? That is an exocrine gland, right? And the pancreas produces digestive enzymes that enter this duct. So the pancreas, right, has part exocrine function. What are the things? It produces enzymes that can digest proteins, trypsin and chymotrypsin, right? It produces pancreatic amylase for the digestion of sugars. And it produces pancreatic lipase for the digestion of, you should tell me, because the way we name enzymes in modern nomenclature is by taking the name of the substrate the enzyme works at and then put an ASE at the end. All right, so a lipase will digest what kind of compound? Lipids. Yeah, that's one of the basic kinds of biological compounds in our body. Okay, amylase was named before that modern convention, and so were trypsin and chymotrypsin. Okay, but don't forget, the pancreas also has an endocrine function because it secretes insulin and glucagon for controlling blood glucose levels. Remember, insulin decreases blood glucose, glucagon increases. So the anatomy of the pancreas, here is the tail, that's the narrow end, and then the head, which is the larger end, is basically attached to the duodenum. And these ducts enter the duodenum. So here is the main pancreatic duct. There is an accessory pancreatic duct that goes a little bit superior to it, and they both empty their contents into the small intestine. The entry of material from the main pancreatic duct goes through this thing that looks like a little pimple, right, or a fingertip. And remember, we call those things, like in the heart, what are those little muscles that look like a fingertip? Those have chordate tendineae attached to them. Papillary muscles, right? So papillae, this thing kind of looks like a fingertip right here. That's a papilla. And so this is what we call the major duodenal papillae. And right before it, there's a little bit of a chamber. And just like the semicircular canals, that chamber is what we call an ampule. And this one right here is called the hepatopancreatic ampulla because there is a tube that comes down from the liver. And anytime you hear that word hepato or hepatic, what should you be thinking of? Okay, if you hear the word gastric, you should think of stomach. If you hear osteo, bone, chondro, cartilage, hepatic or hepato would be liver, always going to be liver. Like hepatitis, inflammation of the liver in particular. Okay. All right, so that's the pancreas. Okay. Well, let's finish up the elementary canal from the small intestine. Material moves into the large intestine. Here is a really nice illustration of a large intestine. Here's the ileum, the last or the distal segment of the small intestine. The first part of the large intestine is the cecum, and off the hanging underneath the cecum is the appendix. And appendix and vermiform appendix are really the same kind of thing. Don't be shocked if you see this word vermiform in front of it. And in other animals, that's a very important part of the large intestine. It's an active cecum that's used to digest things that are really hard to digest, like cellulose or bulk that is in our food, right? And we don't eat so much plant material to where the cecum is necessarily used to break down plant material. But rabbits that only eat plants have a huge cecum. Could be even larger than the whole large intestine. Okay? And in us, it has shrunk down to form an appendix. It's a vestigial organ, but it still nonetheless is pretty important because it contains a lot of malt. And what does your body use malt for? Fight infection, right? So it's an important part of your immune system. Okay, so here is the ascending part. So what kind of motion moves material from the cecum up to this first bend right here? What kind of motion is that? It could be segmentation or peristalsis. Going in one direction, not forwards and back, but only in one direction, that is peristalsis. Even though you see these little pockets, it kind of looks like maybe segmentation is taking place right here. That's just an illusion. These little pockets are called haustra. Okay, so it is peristalsis that will move material only in one direction. So there are smooth muscles in the small intestine, and they attach to this connective tissue line that moves in a longitudinal fashion right through the large intestine. That's what we call tinea coli. Okay, tinea coli is this kind of acts as an insertion point for these smooth muscles. There are little appendages of adipose tissue hanging from tinea coli. We call these epiploic appendages. Somebody in the world might know why they are there, but then again, there might not be anybody that knows. I certainly don't know. It's probably still a mystery. But there's probably a reason why they're there. Okay, so those are some features, right? So let's complete the just gross course of the large intestines. You got cecum, ascending colon. Then it makes a 90-degree bend, right? And it's called a flexure, and it's on the right side of the body, and the other organ on the right side of the body is the liver. So sometimes it's called the hepatic flexure, right? Hepato means liver. Transverse colon. Then another bend very near the spleen, so we call that the splenic flexure, but it's also on the left side of the abdominal cavity, so you could call it either one. Right? And then we have the descending colon. The squiggly part here is the sigmoid. Then here's a collecting point for material. This is the rectum, and then this is the exit point of material, right? The anal canal. And here is a sphincter, external anal sphincter, that just controls the passage of food, right? Or not food, but digested material through, out of the large intestine. Okay, so what moves, right, through this anal canal and past the external anal sphincter? It is what we call feces. So what's the function of the large intestine? The function of the large intestine is to produce feces. And we need to talk about that a little bit. Okay, what does that mean, production of feces? Well, The function of this whole system right here is no longer digestion. All digestion takes place, right, or should be completed in the small intestine. There shouldn't be any large building blocks of anything. Everything should be broken down into simple sugars and amino acids. And furthermore, all those nutrients should be absorbed by the small intestine. So nutrients should never enter the large intestine because the small intestine has done its job properly. So the function of the large intestine is to absorb water and some salt and put it back in the body. All right, so how much water have we lost if you consider saliva, gastric juice, and intestinal juice? 1.5 from saliva, 1.5 from gastric juice, say 2 for intestinal juice. So that's 5 liters of water that you have lost every day. So the function of the large intestine primarily is to absorb water so you do not dehydrate. Right? That's probably the most important function. And when water is resorbed from all that digested material, then that is what we call fecal production or feces. The leftover material that is kind of dried out, that is feces. Another important function is because the large intestine has a lot of normal microbiota, a lot of bacteria. Those bacteria, as I mentioned before, produce things that we need, and in this particular case, vitamin K is produced by bacteria in the large intestine. Does anybody know what vitamin K is good for? This K doesn't stand for potassium. It's a vitamin all by itself. It's important because it makes blood clotting factors. It's important for blood clotting function so that if you ever cut yourself, you stop bleeding. Without vitamin K, when you cut yourself, you will just bleed, okay? And that's not a good thing. So that's another job of the large intestine. Well, we got to stop, but I got to say more about the large intestine. A lot of people die every year because of things that go wrong in the large intestine. And make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And we're going to move up to lab. We're almost done with this particular chapter. Okay, sign-in sheet is there. So what's a better model of an alveolus? This latex glove or my handy paper bag? The glove is much better. Okay. You guys upstairs.